The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With these words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, which is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm G. Chair of The Nation. Now, this week, we're going to take up the sort of story of Graham Plattner and what's happening in Maine. And I'm very happy to have on frequent guest of the program, Owen Higgins, as we talked about recently, author of a really great book, Owned. Someone who has a very good grasp of the politics of the area, because I think that, like, when we're talking about Graham Plattner, there's a specifically Maine story that I think gets left aside because, as in so many other elections, it's become nationalized. So first of all, I want to say, Owen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's just, I think people, you know, have obviously heard of Graham Plattner, but let's just catch everyone up. Like, where are we right now? What's the state of play? He had a sort of spectacular rise, got 71% of the vote in the primary. There are always people who had doubts for him for a variety of reasons, which you can go into. And then now he's had a even equally spectacular fall. So what is this sort of Graham Plattner story?
Yeah, so I'll try and summarize it relatively quickly, just because I assume that a lot of your listeners will probably have at least the broad strokes. But Plattner kind of exploded onto the scene back in August 2025, possibly July, but I think August was when he really started to make waves. He was a candidate for Senate. He was running as kind of like an outsider Democrat. He had a populist left-wing message that was, you know, kind of hitting all of the left Democrat points, you know, an outspoken support for trans rights, outspoken support for Palestine, and a kind of unequivocal condemnation of Israel's genocide in Gaza. He was anti-corporate power, and he also presented himself as opposed to not only Susan Collins, the incumbent, the Republican incumbent, but also to the Democratic establishment. So these things all kind of work together to present him as a rather left-wing candidate. He was packing town halls and other events throughout the state. Now, Maine is pretty small, right? 1.8 million people. The size of the state geographically is almost as big as the rest of New England. It's heavily forested. I think per capita might be the most rural state in the nation. Down where I live in the kind of the Portland metro area is kind of where most people live. But you know, there are 1.8 million people here. So if you are campaigning, you do have to go up into the state, into and north and, you know, out to the coast. And he was doing that. I think he did like 80 town halls up until, you know, just recently, and kind of getting his message out. And that made him quite popular. But also at the same time, you know, in the fall, last fall, we started to see some hints that there were problems. First, he had a Totenkopf tattoo, which is the Nazi death's head tattoo. Now, it is true, I just want to be clear, that it is true that the German military has had a Totenkopf tattoo or a Totenkopf symbol for many, many years before the Nazi Totenkopf one, but the one that he got is the specifically Nazi one. He said that he didn't know when he got it, and that he only found out about it in October. The first one, I think I believe. The second one I don't find credible, but whatever, he got it covered up. Then his old Reddit post came out, and there were a lot of questionable comments about people in rural Maine, black people, women. There were some comments about women who are raped, and you know, if whether or not they have responsibility for their own assault. Comments that were disgusting, but that, you know, he said, "I've changed. You know, I've gotten, you know, I got better." To quote the X-Men, right? That he had somehow kind of like come past this.
The general narrative he presented was that, like, you know, he was a guy who had, you know, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, had been, you know, suffered from the sort of very common traumas of soldiers, had been messed up, had a period of, like, alcoholism, but that he was, like, you know, working to redeem himself and that he was improving. And I think that that narrative in particular, like, seemed, like, very effective. Like, I think... Yeah, people recognize that, like, this, you know, like, many of us, you know, have, like, flaws and have imperfect histories, and you don't want to be, you know, judge people by their worst moments. So, I mean, I think that there was a kind of compelling narrative there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention he was a veteran. That's, like, a huge part of his appeal. Also an oysterman in coastal Maine. You know, I mean, you know, there were attacks that maybe he was presenting himself as too working class when he wasn't really that working class. And his supporters would say he's more working class than that. At that point, it kind of becomes this back and forth, kind of endless and kind of boring back and forth on that. The establishment, the Democratic establishment, kind of led by Chuck Schumer, had kind of cleared the lane for Janet Mills to run. That's the governor here. She is 78 years old. She never seemed like she was particularly into it. And by the time that she jumped into the race, Plattner had just a massive lead. She tried to hit him pretty hard with some negative ads around February. Those did not land at all. So she basically suspended her campaign and stopped campaigning. There was one other candidate, David Costello. I don't think he ever polled below above 2%. So kind of not even really worth going into him right now. No offense to Mr. Costello, but just, you know, for the purposes of this. So Plattner continues to have success. He's a sensation. He's getting tons of media coverage. Now, these scandals are continuing to kind of bubble under the surface, but nothing has really, like, come out. June 9th was the primary, there was a story that dropped a week before, or I think maybe earlier than June 9th. There was a story that dropped in early June with allegations from an ex of his called Lindsey Feifeld, saying that he had been physically abusive toward her. That just physically abusive. There were a few other women quoted in the piece who said that, you know, maybe he wasn't the greatest with women, but not alleging anything, including this woman, Jenny Rassicot, who said that she had dated him a few years prior to that. While I think a lot of us would find physical abuse to be a hard line, the voters of Maine did not think so and gave him a 53% lead over Mills, who got 19%. Again, she wasn't even campaigning at this point. And Plattner seemed like he had kind of a glide path to go up against Collins. And at this point, as someone who had been following this race and as somebody who has lived in Maine for a while, I thought that he had a pretty good shot to beat Collins at this point. Now, I just want to say that because before we get to the end of his campaign, which is, I guess, ongoing now, it depends on what's happened by the time that people are listening to this, but over the course of the month of June, he really dipped in the polls. There's a reporting now from the New York Times that by the time that this latest scandal dropped, he only had $100,000 cash on hand, which I find almost impossible to believe. But, you know, hey, like if they're reporting it, the New York Times doesn't usually get stuff like that wrong. Obviously something had started to crumble a little bit. I noticed, like, because I watch a lot of baseball, and so I would see a lot of campaign ads, and running up to the primary there were tons of them for Plattner, tons of them, and tons of them for Collins. So not only like as for Collins from Collins, but from her super PACs and also from PACs for Platiner. But in the last few weeks, even before this, I noticed that the Platiner ones have kind of started to dissipate a little bit. And the only ones that were really still on were these PAC ones that were criticizing Collins, but for, you know, things like veterans' rights and like stock trading and voting with Trump, et cetera. But none of it was like kind of specifically pro Platiner. And then on July 6th, then it drops. Do you want to add anything before I get
there? No, well, I was only going to say one reason for perhaps the drop in the polling. My sense is that there had also been a kind of, you know, parallel scandal of sort of sexting while being married and sort of, you know, I don't have to. It never did amount to like actual physical adultery, but he was clearly doing a lot of bad behavior. And my sense is that in particular hurt him because, again, it didn't quite fit into the narrative because this is all actually stuff that had happened like while he was already running as a candidate. So it didn't.
Well, not when he was running as a candidate, but within the last 3 years. Yeah, I did notice that the lady up the street who had a Platiner sign for a very long time did pull it when the sexting scandal came out.
And I do think that it sort of complicated the sort of what I think was the redemption narrative that he had successfully had and made people, you know, have a second look as to who this guy was. So he had won the primary, but his polling was going down. And there's plausible reasons to think that his money was also running out.
Yeah, exactly. And just like one other thing about the sexting thing, too, is that, you know, I don't think that was insurmountable. Ultimately, I think at this point, people are probably at the level where they're like, you know, what happens within a relationship happens within a relationship. And you just kind of have to would really kind of come down to like, is this more important than, you know, putting Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court? You know, leading to the end of Roe. I mean, that was kind of what the Democrats were aiming to do. You could kind of see that coming. But then,
I don't know if represented a change because originally he was running as a sort of, I'm offering a positive alternative. I will be the sort of populist alternative to both Susan Collins and the Democratic Party. And, you know, already, you know, within the last month before this latest scandal broke, I think he had been reduced to having a lesser evil argument, you know, which is always an inspiring one. Like, even though I think it can sometimes work, and I think certainly Susan Collins is someone who, especially if she's running in a Democratic state, and really is these, you know, one of the senators most singularly responsible for the end of like abortion rights. Like, I think he could have eked out a victory as a lesser evil, but that in itself was a reduction from what he originally was running as.
Yeah, let's put a pin on pin in that just for a second, because I think that'll come up once we get to what's going on now, or like what would come next. Now, the primary election happened in early June, and there was really no stopping Platiner at that point. And really, the only way that you could stop Platiner is if he somehow were to drop out by July 13th, in which case, up until that point, the state party would have 2 weeks, either 2 weeks or a complete deadline of July 27th, I can't remember which one it is, in order to find a replacement for him. So on July 6th, 1 week before that, Politico publishes a story from Jenny Rassicot, the same woman who I mentioned before, right, who had been in this story, who had mentioned that he had been mostly good in their relationship, but that there had been one incident that she kind of like hinted at in the New York Times story, but didn't go into it. The details are pretty hard. I'll kind of go over them very quickly, which is basically that he entered her home without her permission while he was drunk and raped her, essentially. I mean, that's her claim. It seems very credible to me. There's no, absolutely no reason to doubt it personally. I don't think that there is.
Yeah, just based on the reporting, I mean, it has the basis not only of her claim, but also like all the sort of stuff that a reporter would put in look at publish it as an article, which is to say that there were like emails and phone conversations showing a relationship. I think that it's And I want to like underscore this point because I've noticed that some people are, I think, quite irresponsibly, you know, casting doubt on the story, but it is a completely credible story. And to be further underscored, a completely horrifying story. That was well beyond anything that had previously been said about him.
It is both of those. And I think that any journalist should obviously question and investigate any allegation like this. However, there are ways to do it. Let's just leave it at that. So basically this has kind of blown up his entire campaign. Yesterday, so we're recording July 9th, it's Thursday. Yesterday, July 8th, he puts out this 11-minute kind of rambling video attacking the Democratic establishment and his former allies, and basically saying that, you know, he's being forced out of the race and that he's, you know, he's choking up, he seems angry. And so just a couple of things about that. One, my friend Nikki McCann Ramirez, who's a reporter for Rolling Stone, she was on MS Now when this video came out, and she said something right after that I thought was really, really sharp, which is, you can tell that this guy's campaign comms team is gone, because there's no way that they would allow him to put out an 11-minute video like this. But it later comes out that that was a condition that he set with his team in order to drop out, that he would be able to deliver this kind of rambling diatribe about this. But his campaign is over. Now, he still has not signed the papers to withdraw, which he has to do by 5 p.m. next Monday, July 13th, depending on when you're listening to this. He has either already done that or not done that, or you're still waiting to see if he's going to do that because it's not 5 p.m. on Monday yet. But, you know, whatever the case, that is his deadline. And while the law allows for the Democratic Party in Maine to replace him, there's nothing about what process they have to go through or how that's going to be done. So the main two, no pun intended, the main two options that were discussed were kind of doing like a mini convention or doing a kind of a mini caucus. Now, a mini convention, which I think is what they're going to do, is taking delegates, proportional delegates from each county and having them all meet for a convention to do that. In order to do a caucus, I think you'd have to do that town by town. That is not something I think is impossible, and I don't think that I'm not saying that it's a bad idea. It does seem very difficult, though, probably more difficult. The thing is, and I posted this online, that, you know, that people are not going to be happy with this. Now, people are not going to be happy with whatever solution there is, right?
I mean, we're in a sort of like a crisis situation.
Emotions are very high.
Any solution you come up with is going to be like an imperfect one. I mean, I think that there's more or less democratic ways of doing that. And I think that, you know, like, to at least have some sort of voter input is very important. And I think one reason is, if one thinks back to Joe Biden dropping out, and then, you know, and then Kamala Harris, one of the things she did was almost immediately secure his support for her being the nominee. And there were people at the time, I'll mention my Nation colleague, John Nichols, because I think he was extremely right about this. And people should have paid more attention to him, including myself should have paid more attention to him, where he said, like, you know, like, we should not, you know, have a coronation of Kamala Harris. You know, we should, even however hard it is to hold a convention or to get people together, you have to have some sort of process to legitimize the nominee. Otherwise, and it could end up being Kamala Harris, but he would not have legitimacy until you do that. And I think that John was right. I think it extremely hurt the Democrats and hurt Harris herself, like, not to have some sort of process where there was input by voters. I think that same lesson applies. And I think the one good thing, whatever they come up with, I don't think the main Democratic Party is going to make the mistake that the National Democratic Party made in 2024. I think that, you know, as you're indicating, however imperfect a solution there is, there will be like some sort of input from more than just the sort of party elite.
Yeah, I think so. So there are a couple of points here to make, and I'll start national, and I'll go down to state. Right. So the first thing I'll say nationally is that, you know, people who are following this online, especially on social media, are probably getting the impression that this is a real drag out fight between these two wings of the party, and that the establishment is trying to really screw over the people, the movement that supported Planner. And while I want to be clear that I think that that is certainly something that could possibly happen, I'm sure that Chuck Schumer would love to do that. But like you know, just he believes in his procedure here, and I think he thinks that his pick would be the best. But if you listen to what surrogates like Neera Tanden, what people from Searchlight Institute, these are kind of more moderate to almost like right-wing Democrats are saying, a lot of them are saying the movement that got Plattner here needs to have an outsized role. And the reason I think they're saying that is that they realize exactly what you're talking about, what John said, is that if you don't do, if you do this in a way that seems illegitimate, you're going to completely lose any chance that you have of getting the seat. You're going to fracture the party, and it's going to just look horrible. So I think that that is worth saying, that while I do believe that it's possible that the establishment, the Democratic Party establishment, may be trying to do some underhanded stuff. I mean, I'll be very surprised if they're not. I do also think that there's a part of the establishment that realizes what a huge mistake that would be, and they're trying to head that off at the pass as quickly as possible. Now, as far as the state party goes, it is hard for me to imagine that they would do something that would completely throw out the desires of the party base. Again, almost 3/4 of voters voted for Graham Plattner. He got over 150,000 primary votes. That's the most votes in the Democratic primary in history in the state. It's a huge turnout for a state that has just under 1 million registered voters, just over 300,000 registered Democrats, to have like 40% of them come out and vote for a candidate is very big in a primary, especially in a rural state, but really in any state.
I think we have one should underscore that Plattner, there was a genuine movement there, and it was a movement, you know, coming out of something that one is seeing all across the country, which is like a Democratic Party base that is very mobilized and very angry and wants a change within their own party. I mean, that is there. And as she said, you know, like it's a huge chunk of the voters, and they can't win without those voters. So, yeah.
Not only can they not win, but this is their party that they, like, it's not even that they are supposed to represent. This is the party that like puts them into power. This is the party that keeps them elects them as leaders. I mean, these are people who they will have to hear from, you know, like, every day, like going down to the market, like, you know what I mean? This is a small area. Like there's a lot of small towns. So I think that needs to be kind of understood and thought about as a potential here. Now Maine has ranked choice voting, which is very important to what comes next, because it has ranked choice voting, you can kind of trace how popular different candidates are. And while we had the Senate election, which was a blowout, right? We also had the Democratic primary for governor. And in that, we saw 5 candidates, and it ended up to be Hannah Pingree, who's the daughter of Shelley Pingree, the representative for Maine's 1st District. And Hannah is going to be the Democratic nominee now for governor. But here's how she did it. In the beginning, when the votes first came in, Nirav Shah, a CDC, he kind of managed the state through COVID. That's how he's very popular here because of that. He was in the lead. I think he had like 36 to 37%. But Pingree, Shana Bellows, who's Secretary of State, and Troy Jackson, former state Senate president, had cross-endorsed each other. And this was actually Graham Plattner's idea, was for the three of them to cross-endorse each other, because then, like, one of those three was likely to make it through the thing, right? So because ranked choice voting, the way that it works is that you count up the votes, and then the lowest vote getter, their votes go to the next, to their second choice. And then those all get distributed, and then you go to the next one. So you keep going until someone has a majority. Now, Hannah ended up winning because Troy and Shanna's voters went to her, or went more to her than to Shaw. So, but now we can see with the data, right? We can see who had the most first round votes, who had the most second round votes. And that's why I think that is probably going to be Troy Jackson, Nirav Shah, or Shanna Bellows. And I'll kind of give you the case for each of them, right?
Sure.
Nirav Shah's case.
And maybe just sketch out who they are. And you've given some of that, but you know, it's good to get some more detail. Yeah.
So Nirav Shah's case is that he led the state through COVID. He's, you know, kind of a career bureaucrat, but he's quite charismatic. You know, like I remember him addressing the state during COVID every day. I mean, he's very charismatic. He inspires a lot of loyalty, I think, within Mainers. Certainly, you know, like my wife loved watching him every day, right? During COVID, like, you know, she thought he was great. So, and that's, you know, anecdotal, but that was, you know, kind of how I got to know who he was as well. And he can reasonably lay claim to having the second most first place votes after Pingree.
Mm-hmm.
So he can say, I have all of this support. This is who I am and what I've done. And he also can do another thing, which he can credibly say, I've done a bunch of town halls around the state. The minute that he and his camp saw how well Plattner was doing by doing town halls all around, they started doing it. So they're very smart. Their campaign is very smart. He's also come out and called Gaza a genocide. He has called for Medicare for all. There are a number of progressive positions that he has, even though he's seen as the moderate candidate, the establishment candidate. There are some questions about some of his funding that may be tied to AIPAC through a couple of different layers down. But you know, for rhetoric, he certainly, you know, sounds the right, makes the right noises, and he has done the campaign, right? So that's the case for Shah. The case for Jackson is that he is the progressive, the labor guy, a genuine working class logger from up in the absolute middle of nowhere, northern Maine. He has the support of labor. He has the support of a lot of progressives in the Portland area. I think he can reasonably claim the mantle of what Plattner was doing. I think that, you know, just as I said with Shah, like that problem with like the funding and some kind of questions about him. I think the thing about Jackson is like the kind of the cons about Jackson are that he's not a great speaker. He's not very fast, like quick on his feet. He has a great team around him. I'm not saying he's stupid. I'm just saying that like the way that he operates is not quite as quick and as slick as some of these other people. He does have a past with some social conservative stuff that presumably they could use against him. And also, like, you know, he's very tied to Plattner. And finally, Shanna Bellows, who's the Secretary of State, she was the, after Pingree, was the number one second choice for everybody, right? So I'm not sure exactly how that all would work out, but you know, essentially it means that of people who were voting for Jackson, Pingree, Shah, and also Angus King III, the very distant fifth place run, who's, I don't think, going to get involved with this at all, but she was the kind of the compromise choice for all of these different candidate supporters. So I think that's a very strong case to be made for her. I think that that's what she could do. She's seen as a progressive, a populist. I think the number one thing that is going to hurt her, the number one con, is probably that she ran against, she's 51 now, so she ran against Collins 12 years ago when she was 39 and got absolutely destroyed. I think by like 30 points. Now, look, this was 2014, right? So if you remember the political landscape in 2014, a little-known Democrat going up against a Republican powerhouse in that year was probably going to get blown out. I don't think that the DSCC put much money into Maine. I think they kind of just gave that one up. But still, she's already been beaten by Collins once, so that is something that certainly people could say. Beyond those three, this Jordan Moore, I think, who ran in the second district for the primary there that was won by Matt Dunlap. There is Kleben. I can't remember what his first name is. He's a Maine beer company owner. He had stepped into the Senate race in the beginning and then it dropped out. He failed to gain traction. And Paige Loud, who is a Native American legislator who is probably the darkest of dark horses here, just because she has probably the lowest name recognition, but would definitely be running like a very progressive, very kind of very left wing, frankly, very left wing campaign. So those are kind of the six that are there, but the three, I think, the governor ones are probably the three main ones.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and my understanding is that this will also be ranked choice voting. So some of the same sort of dynamics will come into play. We don't know for sure, but I mean, we don't know for sure. Okay.
I would imagine though. I mean, well, it's a convention with delegates. I think that they might do it as kind of I really don't know how they're going to do it. I don't think they know how they're going to do it yet, quite honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we should be frank that it's all up in the air. Because what you were saying earlier about ranked choice voting, I think is very interesting. Because I mean, to my mind, if they do have that, then it would benefit the sort of candidates who are the best at sort of coalition building, and you know have a sort of record on that. But I mean, we will see as it sort of progresses. Now, do you think that being associated with Plattner will be considered a harmful thing going forward, or people will just like, you know, because Plattner had a lot of support in the state, so they'll think like, okay, this person got fooled the same way I did, and you know, like it's not, you know, something to be held against them.
Really hard to know right now. The main GOP is already going after Bellows for her association with Plattner. I believe they're also going after Jackson. I think they see Bellows as a bigger threat. That might just be my unconscious bias in that I think that she's going to win. So I would think that she's the biggest threat, but however, that's my prediction. My predictions are almost always wrong. So who knows? I think that it will be used, but here's the thing is that they can just flip around and say, well, yeah, and then we forswore him while, you know, Susan, people asked you if you regretted your vote for Brett Kavanaugh as recently as the middle of June, and you said no, you know? So I don't know how strong those attacks are going to be. Frankly, if I'm the GOP and I'm Susan Collins, I am absolutely irate that this story didn't come out a week and a half later. Before they could do this, I'm very angry about that, right? Like, I think that they are very upset about it because their chances of retaining the Senate seat just went down because she was starting to, like, they were starting to go up. She has 9.3 million on hand. He had 100,000. You know, like the super PACs are prepared to put in like $400 million or something like that. You know, so if we split that 50-50, it's 200 each. I mean, this is going to be the most expensive Senate race that's ever been run in this state by a huge margin.
I want to underscore something that this is, as you said, like a state with like maybe like a million voters, right? So you're going to spend like, you know, like the combined two parties, like, you know, $400 per voter.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild. It's wild. It's really crazy. I think that what we're probably looking at here is a GOP that is actually kind of scared right now and worried. And I think that they want the weakest candidate possible. You know, I think that like they want someone in the Janet Mills mode, in mold, you know, that is putting forward a type of politics that is actually quite unpopular, not only with the Democratic base, but see, here's the thing is that Susan Collins wins because she converts all of these nice, moderate, liberal, Democratic women in the suburbs, right? So they will vote for, you know, say, say Biden, right, in 2020, like this would happen Biden 2020, but then they'll also vote for her. Now, other things happened in 2020 with Sarah Gideon's campaign that were very bad, but we don't have time to get into all that. But she's able to get that support. So that was 6 years ago. What's happened in the last 6 years? Well, Roe's gone now. The Supreme Court is incredibly just anti-woman and, just chipping away at whatever reproductive rights remain. Trump is in office. Trump is despised here. I mean, I live in the metro area, so I live a little bit inland. If you go a couple more towns in, they certainly feel a little bit more positively about Trump, I'll put it that way, than they do in, closer to the coast. But Trump lost by like 7 points here in 2024, and things have only gotten worse since then. Democrats are really fired up. I think that if I'm Collins, I'm worried. And if I'm the Democrats, I want to find the right candidate who's going to be able to fight her on her own, on these terms, and be able to turn people out. I think that one of the problems with Gideon in 2020 was that her campaign kind of, to the extent that it got off the ground, it kind of dipped at the end, and they weren't really able to like maintain any kind of enthusiasm or excitement. So I think they need to be very, very smart in how they do this. And I think if it were up to me, I would say, someone like, I think running a man might be a mistake in this environment after what just happened. I don't know. Maybe not. It's really hard to tell. But I think that someone like Bellows would probably do the best. But I think that Shaw could do well as well. Again, I want to be really clear. I'm not making a judgment on their policy platforms, their politics, what they represent. I'll say this. Rhetorically, they appear to be where the party is at. I don't know if they're really where the party is at. I'm saying rhetorically, they appear to be where the party is at. If they can run a race that gets there, that's great. But I do just want to go back to Mr. Platner here for a second, because again, like I said, he has not filed the paperwork yet to withdraw.
Yeah. And the deadline is a day after this airs. So many people will be listening to this on Sunday. We'll find out on Sunday whether he does this or not. As you said, there might still be options, even if he doesn't file. I mean, I do actually think that the video, 11-minute video that he did, is worrying in the sense of it shows someone who is not thinking about anything larger than himself. He appears very self-pitying and very aggrieved, in a way that, like, I think underscores as much as anything his total unfitness for office.
I agree. And Morris Katz, who is the consultant who helped Zoran Mamdani to victory and helped Platner to victory in the primary, has said that he will side by Bundy. And I checked that with the source that I have in the campaign, and that source also said that he is definitely going to do it on Monday. So we'll see. It's very possible by the time that this comes out that he's already done it, like on Saturday or Friday, sometimes on Sunday. And so this whole conversation that we're having here is kind of just all academic. But I know that you wanted to touch on this, and I know we only have a couple of minutes left, but this idea of these consultants coming and kind of...
I'm glad you mentioned Morris and Katz and the and Mamdani, because I think there's actually an interesting comparison to be made in terms of difference, that I think with Mamdani and with the sort of broader New York politics, what you have is a real sort of grassroots organization in place within the form of the DSA. Katz is a consultant. He made the, very successful kind of like ads that Mamdani did. But it's like, Mamdani and the success that the DSA had had in municipal elections, in congressional primaries, goes well beyond like sort of the political consulting class, and is a very organic sort of phenomenon. And I think Platner, I don't want to say the organic aspect of his support, which I think is a real phenomenon, which I think we have to you know, acknowledge and come to terms with. But this whole sort of model, you know, as is reported in the New York Times, of basically these sort of headhunters coming in, you know, seeing this video of Plattner, thinking, well, you know, this is a guy we can sell, you know, not apparently doing much due diligence in terms of his background. I think that, you know, to me, to my mind, that's very different than a kind of DSA model. But I'd be curious on your thoughts on this.
I think that's absolutely right. And I do think that Katz is maybe getting a little overly raked over the coals about this, because he was not the one who vetted him. Dan Barath and they spent like $6,000 vetting this guy and said, okay, it's fine. And the thing about vetting is that, you know, they have to tell you what to look for. And it's very clear that even now, like Plattner doesn't think that any of this stuff really happened, or that, you know, that it's even worth like looking at. So, you know, like, to what extent do you have? I mean, for months, I was hearing from people close to Plattner that there was some stuff out there, but it was just like consensual kink stuff, and that, like, you know, that's all that there was. And I think that's probably what he told them. And so, anyway, setting that aside, I think that there is a point here where they came in and they were like, hey, we want this candidate. We want a candidate that works. And we want someone who can speak to the main voter. And they found this veteran, well-spoken, educated, deep voice, you know, like can really like make the case, I think, for these policies. And I don't think they really looked like too deep into it otherwise. And I think they kind of believed him for what he said. And then once he took off, I think that at that point, like you couldn't stop it. I mean, like he was filling, you have to understand, like after the Totenkopf scandal, he was filling rooms. They were cheering for him. And the thing is, because Maine voters didn't want to feel, they felt like DC was stepping in here and stopping them from making their own choice. And that is one thing that people in Maine are not going to like at all, right? And so they really, really push back on that. I think that, you know, the consulting class really like does deserve criticism. They deserve to be made fun of. They deserve to be, I think, rigorously attacked for not doing the vetting. I think that's all true. To me, though, the problem is that this is a very serious scandal that has happened, right? Well, not that it's happened, the scandal that has come out about something that's very serious, not a laughing matter. And like using it to score points is like might feel good in the moment. But if you really look at it, like, why did Plattner do so well? He did so well because the people of Maine supported him, because 150,000 of them, of Democrats and independents, voted for him in the primary because he was filling town halls across the state. That is why he won, not because people were tricked by consultants. He won because the message that he was running, the politics that he was running on, is something that has broad appeal. And we've seen that with candidates that are not as flawed as him, right? I would say Zoran Mamdani is the polar opposite. Like someone who's so squeaky clean that it's almost, you know, it's like night and day, right? Or you have like AOC or Bernie or you know, any number of these progressive lawmakers that are like either very either just very popular within their districts, but also very popular nationally. And so I think that we just have to understand it in that context, and to just say, oh well, this was like, you know, a case of the left not vetting them, you know, like Neera Tanden saying the establishment vets their candidates, like Eric Swalwell's like right there. Like, what are you talking about? Like, this is, you know, this is ridiculous. But
yeah, no, I mean, so, in the case of Neera Tanden, this is someone who has worked with, you know, like Bill Clinton, you know, praised Andrew Cuomo, and, you know, hired Larry Summers to come up with their Project 2028. So I'm not sure I take her vetting skills. And in fact, in some ways, the vetting is, I think we can maybe agree on this, that it's a bit of a distraction from the main issue, which is, you know, this is a deeply flawed guy who basically lied to people in a very disturbing way. And then, and on the flip side of it, though, like, did like, you know, win a very impressive primary because people resonated with his message. So the thing to carry forward is the sort of, you know, the politics that people want, even if they don't want the candidate now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I would just
add with just one thing, which I think is very positive, which is like, this is a guy who ran on a politics, a movement politics, right? The minute that this stuff came out, people dropped him instantly. No, don't want that. But did not drop the movement, did not drop the politics. And I think that does show you that, like, that there is like some a level of mercenary political acumen within the left movement that I think is important to be out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it can never be about just a candidate. That's a dead end. And so, I mean, yeah, the struggle continues. I want to thank once again Owen Higgins for being on the program and for this very enlightening talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.